I was talking to Brother Milt Willie. You know, Brother Milt Willie is our executive secretary in the Lord, isn't that right? And you notice he has this finger that's sort of tied up and has his foot on it. And I was asking about that. And he says he claims he cut it in a buzzsaw down there. And here we can get this verified afterwards. But so he cut in the buzzsaw and he went down to the dock and he says the dock put in 11 stitches. And he was kind of worried about that finger and he said to the doc, he said, Doc, he says, am I going to be able to play the piano? And Doc says, oh, no worry at all, just don't worry about that. You'll be able to play the piano just fine. And Milt told me that he said to the doc, well, boy, that sure is great because I haven't been able to play it up to now.
Haven't you guys heard that joke yet?
I got my joke a week from Brother Mel. But I don't know how much of that was true. Did he really get in the bus off?
I think he did.
Did he get 11 stitches?
Was that?
Well, at least that part was that right. But anyway,
I think it's true also that he can't play the piano.
Anyway, if he can't play the piano, he can do some other things. He can certainly sing. And as you know, he sings in a group of barbershop quartetters, and they have recently won something locally and then statewide. How far are they now, Frank?
In the west part of California, that they're going into.
They're competing. They won the state competition.
Anyway, they've got pretty far along, you see, and they're quite good. Now, they didn't get that way, Bishop.
They're supposed to sing a staff on me
tonight. Well, that'll be great. Well, I didn't get that way, you know, by just sort of moving along as things move you. They had to make some commitment to get into that kind of a position. And in that case, that commitment meant practice, 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 practice. Also, they had to get some education as to what it is, you know, how you sing, and just what this particular specialty of singing and barbershopping is all about. How you can sing at the right level when the other guy is singing at some other level to produce the right harmony. Well, it all took commitment. Now, a priest makes commitments. All of us make commitments. And in some cases, those commitments need to be made rather early in our lives. Reed Nibley tells me that he's had mothers come to him with their 12-year-old daughter or son and say, I want my daughter or my son to become a great piano player like you. And he says, he tells them, forget it. You haven't made the decision soon enough. If you're going to be a truly great piano player and be able to compete at the national level and be recognized, you know, nationally as a great pianist, 12 years old is too late to make the commitment. You got to do it by at least 8, but preferably maybe about 4. And he points out that this is true of Mozart and all of the other classically great piano players. You just can't start when you're 12. Now, that's not true of all things. We can make the commitment at a later date than 4, but as priests, 16 and 18, time's going to be passing for us, and we need to look around and see if there aren't commitments that we need to firm up now before it's too late. Have you ever Well, I'm sure you have. All of us reflect. We look back at our early selves and our early recollections. I want to ask you to, this is kind of an experiment. I'm just interested because I somehow or other tried to ask myself this question just last night. For a minute, in your mind, try to think of your earliest recollections concerning yourself. Just go back to when you were 3 or 4 or however far back you can go and try to recall your earliest recollection. Will you just take a few seconds to do that?
I have too far to go back.
You don't have as big a problem as I have.
It's a problem, isn't it?
Okay, has everyone had time to do that? All right, now do a second recollection. Recall something from just yesterday that happened to you that sort of, you know, is the thing that you first think of. Okay, now let me ask you, how did you perceive yourself? And I need to talk for a minute. In first person or in third person? In other words, did you perceive yourself as though you were up there on a movie screen and you saw this little 4-year-old boy walking around or doing something? That would be kind of third person, you know. Like you see yourself at the distance on the movie screen. Or did you sort of feel like you were that, you know, it was within you. You were that little fellow again. And from within, first person, you imagined yourself in this situation or walking around or whatever. And ask yourself that question for the long time ago or for just yesterday. And were they different or were they the same? How many of you sort of saw yourself on the movie screen when you were much younger in the incident? And how many of you sort of just, you know, felt inwardly, you just felt it from inside, you were that little guy doing this? Yeah, snakes. Now how about yesterday, the event of yesterday, how many saw it on the movie screen? And how many of you sort of just felt it? That reaction was different. That's the same way it was with me. A long time ago, I sort of saw it on the movie screen, and it was just yesterday. I mean, I'm still me and whatnot. I just sort of, it was closer to me, and I just sort of felt it as first person inwardly. But third person, I saw that young fellow back all those years ago. By the way, my first recollection is kind of interesting. I was out behind the house and I was talking to a little neighborhood boy. And this boy wasn't LDS, he was Catholic, but we were in a big discussion, serious, wondering how when you paid your tithing, and a little Catholic boy put it in the plate or however they do it, how the bishop or the priest gave the money to God. That's the earliest thing I can remember. And the reason I remember it is because my mother heard us talking about Jesus and God, and we must have been talking fairly loudly because she heard it in the house. She came out and asked me if I was swearing. She's going to stop that, you know, before it got hold, catching on to these neighbors. But, and I suppose that's why I remember, but I explained to her, no, we weren't swearing, we were just talking about this problem and wondering how that was done. When I look back to earlier years, I recognize some interesting situations. I lived in Marion, which was a little farming town about 5 miles northwest of the center of Ogden. And a couple of stone throws straight down the same road I lived on, just about 2 farms away, there was a Marriott family. The town was named after these people. And one of those Marriott fellows was J. Willard Marriott. He was 20 years older than I. He had younger brothers that I knew better. But this J. Willard Marriott made some commitments at a later date, which were okay. He made them when he was somewhere around 20, 1927, 28. He left Marriott, went to Washington, D.C. with his wife, just married, opened up their stand, and he decided he was going to be a businessman, and he was going to make money. And he's done it, hasn't he? He might be one of the wealthiest men in Washington. Yeah, he sold a few root beers. But see, he decided on this. He was leaving the farm, he was going into business. And he didn't do it all at once, but he made the commitment, see? Started out with a root beer stand. Now it's an empire. Well, if you go just sort of southeast from where I live, across the railroad tracks into a... Marriott was kind of a tough area, at least I thought it was when I was a kid. Man, the kids swore and did all kinds of things. Beat me up. I was just a little kid. And we moved out there from the city when I was 7 years old. And these big bruisers of farm boys used to pitch in hay and all the rest of that. They were generally a little older. I was young. I was a class ahead of where I really belonged, according to my age. And these bigger guys would twist my arm, trying to make me say who my girlfriend was. They'd beat me up, make my nose bleed, and all kinds of things. But it had its good aspects. But as I was saying, just to the northwest, or the north, the south, no, it's got to be the southeast, across the Southern Pacific Railroad tracks, was a still tougher area in that Ogden area. And that's where Ernest Wilkinson lived. And he was about 25 years older than I was, so I didn't know about him living there in that same general area until much later. But here's a man who made some commitments. I've heard him talk about him. About the time of World War I, he was just the right age to be drafted into the service. And he was really sick with the flu. My uncle died of the flu in World War I. Many people got this bad flu and died. And Ernest Wilkinson was in this fix and almost died. But he had a lot of things he wanted to do before he died. And he has told on a number of occasions how he prayed. He prayed mightily, and he made a commitment with the Lord. He told the Lord if he'd save him from dying from this flu, that he'd do some things. Now, I've forgotten some of the details, but I believe he might have been at BYU at that time as a cadet or something. I don't know. Do you remember? You heard the story? Anyway, he made some commitments about doing something for BYU. If he ever was in a position to do it, he would do it. He would do something for that school. And he would do something for the church. Well, he not only made that commitment, but he got himself out a piece of paper, card I guess it was, and he wrote on that thing a lot of commitments that he was going to do. And most of these had to do with what he's going to do in his life. A goal. Well, goals and commitments are intimately intertwined. And he has said at a number of meetings I've attended that he had reached every one of those goals. He had made every one of those commitments but one. And no one at any of these meetings had ever dared ask him what the one goal was. Now, many of us talking in private about this very interesting but wonderful character, Ernest L. Wilkinson. I thought maybe it was to become senator. Remember, a number of years back, he resigned from the BYU to campaign for senator, and he never made it. But I would, you know, some of us try to guess what his goals may have been. Well, one of them, I think, was to become a millionaire. And he did that, see? But he had never done it if he hadn't made the commitment. And then, of course, the time came when the authorities in the church, Wilkinson was out there in the world, he became a a lawyer of much fame. He'd been president of the stake in New York City. He'd been a bishop there, all kinds of things. He was well known in the world for the things he'd done. Doesn't recognize his abilities and called him to be president of BYU back around 1952. And his opportunity came without him asking for it. The Lord had taken care of the matter, and here he was in a position to do something for the BYU. And as you can see, he surely did. Well, these commitments put us in a position sometimes where it is difficult to hang on to our commitment. We need to be prepared to fight it. You may be in a situation where someone will try very much to pull you away from your commitment. That's easily seen in a Word of Wisdom commitment. I think all of you guys have made a commitment that you're going to live the Word of Wisdom, and you, in your mind, you're going to stand by it. I'm just convinced of that. And you've probably already met the situation where somebody is going to literally force you by ridicule or some other means to break that commitment. Now, sometimes a commitment may tug you in some other directions other than this kind of a direction. Praise. Somebody may praise you in such a manner that you would want to get more of the praise, be pulled away from this commitment you have made. So you have to stand the opposition, no matter how it is, on the commitment that you have made. Now, I thought it might be interesting to list at this point the religious commitments that we have made as priests. All of us will have made some of these same commitments. Let's put them on the board. What are some of the commitments we have as priests?
We have all the commitments of the deacon and the teacher.
Okay. You don't drop those when you become a priest. Okay. Can we name some specific things?
Well, endows blessing, it's like baptism. You baptize people. Bless the sacrament. Warnings about the members to repent. Things like that.
Well, the commitment in that case is to do these things,
service.
I guess, as required. Okay, duties, maybe, and service. As the authorities, those in authority require, and then I guess that some aspects of this are voluntary. That could be on a voluntary basis. You would need to wait for somebody to authorize you to do it. But it's true even at the sacrament table. You just don't go up there and do it. These brethren up here make the appointment. Bishop?
Everyone here has made a commitment to sustain the group leadership.
Okay.
That was an open...
Unfortunately.
Verbal commitment. Those two are in.
Any other things that we might name?
How about this one, please?
Okay, let's put this under with deacons and teachers. Things that have gone before. Let's deal with us. Is that all right? Fail.
Set an example. Right, precept.
Yeah, now that's a real good one because. Don't those young fellows look up to you priests? If they see you out of line, they think it's okay. I remember how I'd look up to the older ones when I was a kid. I can remember, couldn't have been more than six. The paper boy would come around and, you know, that's something. This guy was riding a bicycle and delivering papers. I looked up to him. And one day, that older boy called me Mr. Hall. And I was only 6 years old. And I, man, I thought he was really, he was greater than ever. He didn't call me Tracy, he called me Mr. Hall. And to me, that seemed like that was something for somebody to call me Mr. Hall. So there are things that you can do that will definitely be an influence on the younger fellows. So set an example. Deliberately set out to do things that will help them in growing up, doing the things that they ought to do. Boost their ego once in a while. We like to look for opportunities to tear it down, I think. Paper boy, when he called him Mr. Hall, was sincere. I think when we call some of these younger kids Mr., it's probably insincere. Doug, what could you add to this list?
Missionary work?
Preparation for it, anyway.
Yeah.
That's a commitment, isn't it? You're going on a mission.
Yeah. Why not missionary work? Why did you shift to preparation?
Okay.
I asked that because I sat here and I wondered if these guys know that advancement in the priesthood does have a commitment to missionary work with it.
Doesn't say that's a responsibility in front of those persons you know.
Yeah. It says in the Doctrine and Covenants, too. That's why you advance in the priesthood, is in preparation for missionary work. And I don't know whether we always think about that or even know about it.
Whether or not many non-Mormons, we can extend that to our own Latter-day Saints, can't we? The ones that are...
President Kimball has told us that that's a commitment, a responsibility we have in terms of the regular missionary call.
State missionary?
Well, he wasn't talking about state missionary, but... Maybe that's the form the call was coming. You know, I don't know how to address that. But President Kimball has said that commitment to do missionary work should be just the same as a commitment to pay tithing, commitment to live the word of wisdom. You mentioned that one. We have commitments there.
Yeah, let's write those down. Word of wisdom. Tithing. Word of wisdom, let me tell you something interesting. I take the Journal of the American Chemical Society and other journals that it sends out, and the last issue of Chemical Engineering News, which is another one it puts out, back page said, Mormons have fewer diseases than any other group in the United States, particularly cancer.
Not cancer.
Full page article, it said, I don't know what it said, the latest study.
They even showed that in Deseret News, they had a thing on
the latest study
Seventh-day Adventists got less
people that have cancer.
Well, this article questioned that. It said it has been claimed that the Seventh-day Adventists are better off still, but it says they're not sure that's correct. The study is not as good as the study on the Latter-day Saints. So, we're seeing the fruits of that daily. In cancers of the stomach, the colon, and the lung, which are real bad cancers, LDS people are 50% lower than the national average. and on all other kinds of cancer, skin, etc., 30% below the national average. In disease in general, much better off than any other kind of group, and much better off than the national average. So there are lots of reasons other than just obeying what the Lord tells us. So tithing, be chaste. Somebody name one I didn't quite hear. Well, our time is up. I'd like to offer you a challenge to reflect on what commitments. We're all expected to make these commitments, and I think in the main we are committed. Maybe you just ought to make it a little more definite. This week, ponder it and think of our commitments that are going to lead us to eternal life. Fairly important ones. But also, we have in this world things that we've got to do. Got to earn a living, got to do other things. And there are commitments that we need to make now. It'll be too late if we wait. And I'd like to challenge you to this week think about commitments, particularly regard to how you're going to earn a living for your family. Things that interest you. Maybe things comparable to playing the piano, but it's not too late to start. Set your goals high. There are some people set interesting goals. I know a guy who at your age set a goal of marrying a daughter of a general authority. Now, I don't know.
That's not too good a goal.
You don't think that's too good a deal, huh? They did it.
Well, you see, okay, then you just go and try to marry anyone as long as they're a daughter of a general authority.
Yeah, but just think the prestige right there.
His reasoning was not just a prestige thing. You look at the kids that's on the general authorities, and they're okay.
They're
well, there are a few who have.
I know, but most of them.
But I know some that they got it. They're spiritual. They support.
Just like other members of the church, they're no different.
Well.
Really, that's true. The bishop, I'm sure, will agree with me on that.
Well, the one this fellow got was okay. I'm telling you. I've seen some children of general authorities that are just great. Well, that's a kind of a different one. Maybe it looks a little outlandish. But a guy made this a commitment, and it was for him, it was okay. Now, maybe there's some commitments that are just for you. Maybe that one was just for this fellow. And look down the road. See if there isn't something that you ought to firm up right now and not just drift along, get it firmed up. Okay.
Okay, Raymond. Super. Stop it.
Yeah. Our Father in Heaven, we thank you for all the blessings asking us. I thank you that we have such a fine lesson. We thank you that we can take part in Dale Taylor's ordination as a priest. We thank you for all the things we've done today. May still please bless us. And all harmonics will come to us today and the city's thanks. In the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Hey, you guys, it's still only transportation money.
When I was young, I asked my mother, what will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be rich? Here's what she said to me. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera. What will be, will be.
Now that was my daughter Virginia singing that song. I heard that song at the BYU at a meeting one time at which President Wilkinson was present. And the gal sang through that first bit. That was just a little bit of it. And Wilkinson told her to quit. Don't sing that anymore. Wonder why he might have said it. And then he explained why. And the girl was kind of mad. But later on, I heard her speak at a sacrament meeting when she wasn't so mad. But why do you think President Wilkinson may have asked her to quit singing that song?
Because we know what the future will be.
Well, I wonder if that's completely true. That's a good comment. How about some more? Well, should I tell you what Wilkinson said? His main point was, he says, that's not Latter-day Saint doctrine. And he says, we shouldn't be singing songs like that at BYU. Now, you know, the president is a pretty strong-willed, and, he got away with it, really, and he did good with it. Now, that's hard to do. I would never have had the stomach myself to turn it off like that. I might have been brave enough to go up to the girl afterwards and say, hey, do you ever think about the words to that song? And what it means, and I wonder if maybe there are places you shouldn't sing that song. Reminds me of when I was a kid in the 1840s in Ogden, about your age, and somebody sang Ave Maria, which is a beautiful music, you know, nice thing, but again, the words aren't LDS doctrine. And the bishop afterwards, he didn't say anything during the meeting, but afterwards he talked to the girl and suggested maybe she shouldn't sing that song. My daughter Virginia, who just sang that for me, said that in the mission she was in Scotland, that somebody sang Ave Maria in church, and the bishop did stop it. And told her that had no place in church. And she and her mother both apostatized and are still mad at the church. So, you know, I think people do not do these things deliberately. So the way that you handle them, you do have to be careful. They recognize that the music is beautiful, and how many pay any attention to the words? I mean, many of us, we sing the hymn week in, week out, and we sort of get the musical sense of the thing, but often we don't get the meaning of the words. Well, as Rob pointed out here, we can do something about the future. This idea expressed in this song is that it's all predestined. Whatever will be, will be. And the implications of whatever may be, will be, just means that we float. We drift. We just sort of have the idea that something will come along, you know, and whatever comes along, okay, we go along with it. Satan himself might be one of his great thoughts, you know, that he sticks around here and there. Probably is. I think in this modern day and age in particular, he's pretty subtle. He's got a good ad man working for him. He doesn't approach things head on or directly. We'd see that. But he deals in more subtle things, such as this kind of an idea that, don't worry, don't let it matter, whatever will be. I think that's one of Satan's real good ideas from his point of view. You know, that's one of his good approaches. Now, we were into this a little bit last time. We were talking about commitment. And we mentioned Brother Reed Nibley and the piano, and how, at least in the case of the piano, he feels you must get started very young. You've got to make the commitment very young if you're going to be really good. And we talked about J. Willard Marriott, Ernest Wilkinson, and commitments that they had made, particularly Ernest Wilkinson writing his down on a card, which he carried throughout his life, so he could look at them every once in a while to see just what he was committed to do, so he'd work at doing it. Towards the end of the lesson, we had some discussion, and I talked about this fellow I knew who had committed himself to marry, you know, look over the daughters of the general authorities and pick one out and marry her. We had a little bit of discussion about that, and some didn't think that was too good an idea. But there are a couple of things, and we mentioned them last time, I'd like to mention them again, that we need to get committed to. One is mission. We talked about that a bit. And the other thing we need to get committed to is what we might call a career. I'm not sure how you spell it. Is there only one R? I think so.
We ought to know, Bishop. Is it?
Why should I know?
Because you teach linguistics.
That's right.
I don't teach linguistics.
Being spelled in foreign languages, maybe he doesn't know it in English.
No way, I'm world worse.
No, it's good to get committed to some kind of a career. We're going to have to earn a living. We're still in a world where we've got to work. The Lord has said that work is a good thing. Church leaders down through the years have pointed out the joys and benefits and blessings of work. We live in sort of a goof-off time, in a way. I don't know whether it matters what your particular politics may be, but it gets kind of worrisome, I think, for people if you get thoughtful and begin to realize that only about one quarter of us are working in productive effort. We're supporting about the other three quarters. Now, I'm counting older people on Social Security and the younger ones growing up who haven't gone to work yet, and then those who don't have jobs and whatnot. Many people think this is one of the things that's sort of responsible for our inflation. See, inflation just comes because people have money to buy things and the producers can't produce enough. Now, I know how that is. I build presses for a hobby, and as you know, I took one to Canada here a while back, and next March I'll be taking one to India. And
need some help carry it?
Yeah, I'll need some help to carry that across. Can you walk on water?
Oh, yeah.
Good. Will you? Anyway, I can't get steel. You can't get steel to save your neck. And it's the same way with almost any raw material. If you want it, nobody cares. I call up a steel mill down in Los Angeles, and I use aircraft quality steels in most of this work. They call them aircraft steels, and they're specialty places that make these. I call them up and say, when can I get a forging certain size? Oh, we're running 2 years behind, they say. And you see, we live in an era when there's so much demand for goods of every kind that the world can't supply them. You see 60 million cars turning up down the roads throughout all USA. Amazing, unbelievable. If we go back, say, to 1936 and try to picture something like that in our mind, you say, oh, it could never be. Well, all those automobiles chew up an awful lot of gasoline. Now, it's present. It's available, at least if we dip into what there is in the Near East. But even that someday will have to run out. So shortage is kind of the order of the day. You can't get things. And another problem is that, you see, there aren't all that many people working producing things compared to all the people out there that have Social Security money or welfare money or aid to dependent children money or just the earnings of the guys who are working wanting to buy the stuff, just not enough to go around. Well, I don't know how I got off on that sort of thing. Maybe I'm reviewing some of my own political philosophy. But anyway, we live in a world where workers are needed. And you guys are going to have to work to provide me with my Social Security. So, see, I have more than one reason for giving this speech.
I thought you paid for your own Social Security through your checks.
I did, but the government spent it. And they rely on the next generation to constantly pay it for the guys who've gone beyond. Now, I don't know when 10 more years when I go on Social Security, I don't know whether you guys will want to pay mine. If I were you, I don't think I would.
You'll be rich enough to retire with that.
Anyway, that's getting to be a problem, you see, because those of us who've been putting in this supposed pension fund, I got my Social Security card when I was less than 12 years old, so I've been paying in for about 43 years. I know there will not be anything that I put in there to pay me. You're going to have to pay it, just like I'm paying those who've gone before me. Well, aside from all those considerations, there can be great joy in work. It can be pleasant, useful, and enjoyable. But we need to pick something. We're not all adept or not all interested in the same kind of things, and so we're going to have to pick some kind of an area where we think we'd like to work. And the sooner the better. And you're at the age now where if you haven't already made the decision, you're sort of going to have to make a decision. Now, let me tell you about my own situation with regard to a decision to work. Well, I lived out in Marriott, Utah when I was young, 13, 18 years. And we had a school, a Marriott school, four-room schoolhouse, best kind of school in the world. We had grades 3, 4, and 5 in the same room, and 1 and 2 in the same room, and so on. There were 2 or 3 grades in the same room. We had a wonderful teacher. Her name was Beulah Stowling. She taught the 3rd, 4th, and 5th grade. Great thing about that, when you're in the 3rd grade, you could hear all that's going on in the 4th grade. And then she'd go over to the 5th grade, she'd just rotate around, you know, you'd hear everything that's going on in the 5th grade. So by the time you got from 3rd to 4th, you knew what it was all about, and she could give you extra stuff. And then the 5th grade, you knew what that was all about, so you get extra stuff there. Well, anyway, when I was in the 4th grade, I was 9 years old, she had the 6 or 7 kids in that grade. The biggest grade there was at the time I was in that school was the 6th grade, and we had 13 kids in the 6th grade. Most of them were just 6 or 7 kids. So there were 6 or 7 of us in the 4th grade, and she asked each one of us individually what we're going to do when we grew up. And unhesitatingly, I said, I'm going to be an engineer and work for the General Electric Company. And I said that when I was 8 years old. Ready to turn 9. Well, that was a commitment, kind of things we've been talking about. Now, I don't know what brought on that commitment. It must have been sort of building up, you know, in my mind. So when the question was asked, I said it out loud to my teacher, and it sort of became a commitment at that point. It brought to a focus, and there was a commitment. Well, now it's not easy, as we said last time, to always live up to these kind of commitments, and things happen along the way. Now, I was pointed in the direction of science. There was no problem there. That's what I wanted to do for a career. Now, there were some holdups along the way. I can remember one came. I went to Weber College, which was a 2-year college, 600 kids in Weber College back in 1937. And that you could do. I could work there as a janitor at the school and make the $70 tuition, which is always required for a whole year in those times. But of course, then $70 was at least as hard to come by as $500 now. But you could do it. Well, then on graduating from Weber in the field of science, then you had to go someplace else if you were to continue. And that would cost more money. So I laid out of school for a full year and 2 summers to earn money to go down There, well, now there was a chance. I wavered as to whether, you know, I would stay out that year and go away to school. And during that year, I got interested in girls and was thinking, boy, wouldn't it be nice just to work around here somehow and get married, you know. School's a drag anyway. So there was a place, you know, where you could waver. But I suppose these commitments were still nagging on me. You ought to do it. So I went down to school. Now, I stood in the registration line at the University of Utah that first day. And registration lines, you know, how you hate to be in those. And I stood there and I waited and I waited and I waited. And I kept thinking to myself, oh, I ain't going back home. It's just not worth it. You know, just a little obstacle like that. But the line probably moved up another step and I stuck it out. So I just barely got through the registration line. Well, another thing happened the following year. I decided to get married, and a married person, a senior in a college in 1940, was somewhat unusual. Weren't too many seniors who were married. Well, I had paid for my education the previous year, and I had saved from working $300. I bought my future wife a ring, which cost me $50, a diamond ring.
My old baby. Probably a big one, too, what?
Yeah, that probably cost you $400 today. And that left me $250 to go to school. So I took my new bride back to the University of Utah for the senior year of school. Well, Major Croft and I was married. He saw to it that I had a little better job than I'd had, and he made some opportunities for me. I hitchhiked to Ogden to work at Sperry Flour Mills, where I'd obtained a job the year before. And I'd stay there over the weekend working. I got 50 cents an hour, which was big pay. That was big pay in 1940.
It's still big pay down here today.
That was as much as the sweepers got in the mill. I was a chemist. I was a kind of an apprentice chemist. I got 50 cents an hour. And that way we were doing pretty good. But later on in the year, the guy who was in charge at Sperry Mills said, hey, what are you going to do with your life? What are your ambitions? I said, oh, I like research and whatnot. I think I'll be a chemist. He said, well, you know what you could do? Research around here. And he says, so-and-so's quitting, and we could give you this job full-time. I was maybe 2 months from my bachelor's degree at the University of Utah. And pay $1 an hour or something. Really way up there, you know, real high pay. Talked it over with the wife, chemist. I'd have been the main chemist there at Sperry Mills. And but they want me immediately. See, they want me to quit school to take the job. And I protested mildly, well, I don't think you got enough laboratory equipment around here. Oh, yeah, we got it, and you want a little something other, we'll buy it for you and whatnot. And I was really tempted. I talked to my wife, and she was tempted too. And we just about told them yes, and then I says, oh, let's go talk to Dr. Bonner. And I went to him feeling kind of silly. Just the act of going to him made me start to see that was quitting school that close to my bachelor's degree would be kind of mad. But I talked to him, and he really didn't say very much. All he did was listen to me. But by the time I got through with him listening to me, I could see that that wasn't the thing to do. So I told him no. Another thing I realized is that there really wasn't anything in Ogden, Utah that a guy could have if he did get a fancy degree in chemistry. And at that point in my life, I thought, boy, Ogden's my hometown. It's a beautiful, wonderful place. This is where I want to be. But we stuck out and got the degree. Now, there's some other things that come along, and I'm just pointing these out because they'll come in your lives. The war came. And I got drafted like everybody else. Took 2 years. And 2 years away from things, You don't know what you're going to do. And I now had a good job at the U.S. Bureau of Mines in Salt Lake City. I had managed to get clear to the master's degree in chemistry before they were after me to go in the service. But I had what was a real good job at that point, the Bureau of Mines. I'd had it before I went in the service, and when I got out of the service, I could go back to it. Good pay. Well, should I stay here? Should I go on for more? Well, I guess these commitments still kept nagging away, so I went away for more. I went to Purdue University, which is where the professors wanted me to go. When I got there, this is right after the war, housing was just so scarce you can't believe it. There was no place that I could find anywhere for my wife and three kids that I now had. Just no place. And the chairman of the Department of Chemistry there says, well, leave your family home for a year. And he was serious. And in my mind, I thought, what the heck? I've been away from 2 years already in the service. I'm not leaving my family just to go to school. So you see, here's another case. Well, I'm just going to quit school, and I'm going to go back to that neat job there in Salt Lake at the Bureau of Mines. But I suppose the Lord looks after you a little bit on some of your commitments. And somehow or other, one of the professors at Purdue said, hey, look, he said, we don't have any really good chemists here anyway. The guy you were sent out to work with, as I knew, decided not to come back to Purdue. He was at the Atomic Energy Commission installation someplace. He says, a well-known Mormon chemist by the name of Henry Eyring has just transferred from Princeton University to the University of Utah. Now, I didn't know this. And he has become dean of the graduate school out there, and he has a better reputation in chemistry than any chemist at Purdue or most any school. Why don't you just go back to school? Now, this is what one of the professors was telling me, but the department chairman at Purdue, he wasn't going to let me go. As a matter of fact, when I started talking about going back to university, he says, I'll blackball you forever with the American Chemical Society. You'll never be able to get a job if you leave Purdue. That same man later on in my life befriended me greatly. He got me a national award, but that's what he told me at the time. Well, I did go back to University of Utah. I was Henry Eyring's first graduate student. And after he came out there, and I finally did get my PhD degree in chemistry, which was a commitment I'd made in my mind many years before. Now I've got a degree, now I need a job. Well, I wanted to work for a General Electric Company. I wrote to them. I was just a country farm boy. I didn't know all the finesse and manners of professional elite kind of people. I sent them a postcard telling them I wanted a job. I'm no kidding. I sent them all postcards. I mean, I was poor. I didn't have any money to write long fancy letters or go down and buy the stationery. So I sent postcards to DuPont and General Electric and I don't know who all, Carbide and Carbon and Eastman Kodak. And they all wrote back to me and said, great, get on the train, we'll pay expenses, come back east and have an interview with us. All but General Electric Company. I got a letter back from them saying that they didn't have any openings.
The cheapskates.
Which I knew was not.
Maybe they didn't like the picture on your postcard.
The picture of Western
Pictures got you
in shock. So, I wrote a letter to General Electric Company and I explained that I had been invited on this tour by a number of companies. And the train did go through Schenectady on its way from Eastman Kodak to New York, where I was going to interview. And couldn't I please stop off and see them? Well, I waited and I waited. I finally got a reluctant letter back saying, yeah, I suppose as long as you're coming through and you can stop off and talk to us. Well, now, there were some other interesting things about this. When I was in the Navy, I managed to get myself into the electronics area, and I finally became a radar officer aboard ship and was in charge of all the electronic and radar gear. So I saw a lot of electrical engineers, many of whom as students had worked for GE on what the GE calls their GE test program. They'd been to Schenectady. And I used to talk to these guys about how someday I'd like to go and work for General Electric Company. And every one of them say, no, you don't want to work for that company. Terrible outfit. I don't know why, but that's the opinion. All these guys that I was associated with in the Navy, who were electrical engineers, told me. They said, besides that, Schenectady is the worst city on the face of this earth. Cold. Why, that wind blows down across those Canadian bays and comes down the Mohawk Valley, and it's so cold you just can't believe how miserable it is. Now, just on one of my trips while I was in the Navy, I passed through Schenectady on the train in the wintertime. And I opened the door and looked out, and I could see it was a crummy-looking city. It really was. Certain parts of Schenectady, just a terrible-looking place. And it was cold, just like those Navy guys said. But anyway, you see, all this youthful commitment was still in my head. I still wanted to work for the General Electric Company, and here they were not even wanting me. And I knew that wasn't quite the case because all the companies were hiring young scientists all over the place. Well, I stopped off there on my way, and I went on to all the other places. I visited four places for DuPont, and they wanted me real bad. They thought I was great. Every one of them just wanted me. Eastman Kodak wanted me. But at General Electric Company, there's a young man by the name of Bill Cass. He was probably about 5 years older than I, who was sort of a junior exactly coming up in the world, and he had a lot to do with these new young recruits. And after the bigger boys upstairs got through with me, Cass told me, I like you. I think you'd be a good man for the General Electric Company. He says, I've got to be frank with you. He says, none of the bosses want to hire you. They don't want you. He says, I get the impression that you really want to work here. And I said, yeah, that's right. He said, well, I think I can convince them. I can twist their arm, but I want you to know the circumstances. They don't really want you. Well, I said, I want the job. I want the job. Well, I came back, and I had offers in writing from all these companies. And I waited and waited, and no offer from General Electric. I waited 6 weeks. I finally called them on the phone and asked them if they're going to give me an offer. And they said, well, it's still under consideration. Well, finally, though, one day, I was in the library, and Henry Iron came looking for me. He says, there's a long-distance phone call you from General Electric Company. And so I was excited and went and got the phone, and they offered me a job. But those were the circumstances, you see. And looking back on my life, I can see the tortuous route to getting to a place where I wanted to get that I had decided when I was very young. Now, in some ways, the General Electric Company may not have been the best place for me to work, to have been working, but in other ways, it was. You never know what the history might be. You know, when I quit General Electric, when Wilkinson asked me to come out here, the director of personnel, you have to have a termination interview, you know, they want to talk to you, they want to know why you're quitting and all this, that, and the other. And he said to me, he said, you know, he says, I guess you know we didn't want to hire you when you first came to the company. I said, yeah, I know that. He said, you know, one of the... He said, you know the main thing that was against you? I said, no, what was it? And he says, you sent us a postcard asking for employment. He says, I'd advise you, if you ever try to get a job again, to be more formal about it. Well, there's some other things, you know. Of course, I had the opportunity to make diamonds at General Electric, and I did it, and that set me up for the rest of my life. But a guy, you know, you wish you'd go back and live your life over again several ways. Make this turn instead of that, and that turn instead of the other. Because after I quit the General Electric Company, I ran into the recruiters from DuPont at an American Chemical Society meeting back in Atlantic City, New Jersey. And these guys really fell for me for some reason. They really liked me as a person. And yet I turned every one of those four divisions down on a job. But all these recruiters took me out to dinner that night. This is just shortly after I quit General Electric. I was out here now and I'd gone back to meeting. And they said, Hall, you don't know it, but DuPont was interested in making diamonds too. And furthermore, if you could work for us, of course, they didn't tell me about any diamond making project. Well, neither did General Electric. It hadn't been formulated yet. Maybe DuPont's hadn't either. But they said, now look, what did you get when you quit General Electric? And I said, it's nothing. They said, look, DuPont had a much better plan. If you'd have done a thing that big for DuPont, you would have collected royalties for the rest of your life, probably $20,000 a year as a minimum, even though you'd have quit us. You did that for the wrong company.
I mean, you're not getting any money for that?
Oh, I just got my salary while I was there. And when
I was sued the heck. All right.
Well, anyway, you know many things can happen to you during your life. But, it was okay, and I suppose there are many decisions that a guy could make, and you'd still come out okay. Well, this has been kind of personal. Maybe I talk about myself too much. But anyway, I just wanted to tell you that it's possible to make a commitment, and I think in my case, the Lord must have helped me. He had to, because there were many turns where I just, you know, teetering could have gone the other way. And I know some of those turns wouldn't have been the right thing. Some may have been okay. If I'd have gone to work for DuPont, things eternally would have come out okay, I'm sure. But if I'd have made the decision to work for Sperry Mills, that would have been wrong as wrong. Or some of the other decisions that I might have made for me would have been wrong. But I think because I had sort of been committed, and maybe I was living worthy enough for the Lord to take care of me a little bit, I think He did. So what I'd like to suggest to you out of my own experience is that you fellows get committed to some kind of a job or some kind of a career, and do it now, because you don't have it. If you haven't done it by now, it's starting to get too late. Now, if there's any way that any of us who are your advisors or leaders can help you in this area, take advantage of us, will you please? And I'd like to suggest that as part of our exploring program, which isn't completely underway this year, that we, and officially this is a part of exploring, that somehow we get in some special leaders who can talk to us about careers that some of you might be interested in. Now, I don't believe that